Radio.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com. Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 14th of December 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com tonight because we have the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II joining us, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing this fine Christmassy evening?
Yeah, that kind of music got going, you know. Heard that since last year.
the Christmas
thing. It's okay. I mean, I meant to send you an MP3 this week, if you remember. I forgot. But quickly, I just say that it was on the Jeff Rentz show, and the subject of the documentary came up. And Jeff Rentz actually came out and said, "You are not an historian unless you've watched that documentary, because otherwise you are living a lie." That's a pretty big statement for Jeff Rentz.
That's quite high praise. Jeff Rentz and Henry Macko, they're probably the top conspiracy theorists. And if you're not including sort of Alex Jones, you know, I would say Henry Macko, Jeff Rentz are about the same level. And both of them aren't pro Hitler at all. I don't think either of them goes into the lies about the Holocaust. So for him to say that is, you know, that's really quite some praise, Dennis.
Groundbreaking, yeah. I thought that, you know.
And, you know, it'd probably make other people aware of the documentary that weren't before. Some of his listeners.
For sure.
I don't think I've heard it mentioned on Stormfront Radio, or I don't think I've heard David Duke mention it. Both of them are on the Rentz Radio Network, and obviously they're nationalists. Yeah. But I don't think that's ever come up in subject matter before. That's great. That's really good news.
He was talking to a German, who goes back to Germany every now and again. And when he comes back again, Rentz sets him on, and they discuss the situation in Germany. He hates Merkel with a passion, does Rentz. Anyway, this German guy brought the subject up. And he was actually threatened with a 1.5 million lawsuit for actually promoting the DVD.
Wow. What, just for putting it in a tweet or something?
I have no idea. I mean, I am going to speak to him sometime or other. We've already been in touch with him. So that'll be interesting. But, yeah, you know, he's obviously comes back with all the tales, what's going on in Germany, which we don't really get in the press. And Jeff Rentz, to his, you know, credit, has had this guy on a number of times.
Well, maybe we could get him on here if you're in... If you're in contact with him, get a report.
Well, it's the website is in contact with me, but I can definitely get the contact number.
You know, even just the name Andrew Anglin is banned in Germany. You don't have to say anything positive or anything negative, but just the words Andrew Anglin are banned in Germany. I was just saying that there was an early podcast with Andrew Anglin on it, and that was all it was saying. And it was on Twitter. Yeah, and they said to me, this tweet is not allowed in Germany. And it can only have been because it had his name on it.
That's unreal, because I've heard that anything with the initials of The Greatest Story Never Told, that is immediately blanket banned.
Yeah, that would be another one.
It's an email there in a blog.
Incredible censorship that they have there that most people are just completely unaware of. I mean, I don't think the conspiracy crowd are aware of just how strong the censorship is over there.
No, I don't.
Regarding this topic.
I mean, a lot of them are interested in Hitler, so don't bother them. But what they do fail to realise is one day that leg's going to come and get bitten.
Well, actually, it is. You know, it is something that we can actually say Great Britain is one of the better countries in Europe for, because we don't actually have any laws against Holocaust revisionism, historical revisionism. You know, Britain and America don't have them. But all the rest do.
I just think we all need them because we're that brainwashed after the war that if you mention that Adolf Hitler, you'd probably get strangled.
Well, yeah, that isn't to say that we don't suffer from the same, hate crime nonsense and political correctness. We're one of the worst countries for political correctness, but we don't actually have any laws saying, you're not allowed to question the 6 million, or you're not allowed to discuss what went on in the war, which I guess is something we can be proud of.
Can I just say the video that you pointed me to last night, Donald Trump video, was amazing. The comments were unreal.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's a definite white pill for us to begin with. Yeah, Donald Trump at the Hanukkah ceremony. If any of our listeners haven't seen it yet, do check it out on radio, on YouTube. Not for the actual Donald Trump at Happy Hanukkah, but the comments underneath. Every single one of the comments is red-pilled, pro-white, and anti-Jew. The Goyim certainly know. I couldn't find a negative comment. Everyone was positive, and all of them had hundreds and hundreds of likes. It wouldn't surprise me if YouTube did something about that and removed them. But what it really shows is that everyone is waking up. Everyone's waking up to the truth, and not just the truth about race, but the truth about the war as well. That's the most, that's the foundational truth, isn't it, really, is what went on.
It's coming out slowly but surely.
Well, we're going to be talking about that again today. We're going to be looking at aspects of the war. And this has been brought about by a video which Dennis saw recently, which he sent to me, and I've had a look at it as well. It's actually a video by Brendan O'Connell. He's an anti-Zionist activist from Australia. People have probably heard of him before. He's done time in prison for his views. I mean, he is a free speech advocate. He's not a white nationalist. He's not a racial nationalist, but he does expose the Jews. And he's brought out a video called Germany Lost the War Because of Subversion and Technology Backdooring. And it's got a lot of interesting information in there. And we're going to go into some bits and pieces of that tonight. One of the things he points out in there, I guess the first topic to get into is really a link between Russia and Israel. And as far as I know, I mean, there's a link between the Soviets and the Jews, but Stalin seemed to be against Israel. And later on in the USSR, they didn't want any of the Russians to be leaving the USSR and going to Israel. But then, of course, once the Iron Curtain fell, then they could go over to Israel again, and a lot of the criminals fled to Israel. And then since then, we say Putin's a good guy, he stands against the New World Order, but Putin also seems to be very friendly with Israel. So, it's hard to know what's what. And Brendan O'Connell is very keen to stress that it's Russia and Israel that are working against us. And I wouldn't go that far, but I would say, maybe he does have a point on some things. So what are your views on that to start off with, Dennis? Russia and Israel being aligned.
For a long time, I sat on the fence with Putin. But recently, I'd seen how close to Israel he was, very similar to Trump in a way. And I think these are two leaders who don't want a communist new world. These more nationalistic, but still, lovers of Zionism. So I don't doubt Brendan O'Connell is right what he's saying. A lot of this technology, he's done some great work on the technology of what Israel is capable of, tapping into every computer and such. So his work's outstanding in that area. He's doing it for about 10 years, I believe. But he spoke about the actual war. Some comments he made were bang on, they really were. But some I just felt needed, some kind of addressing, because he didn't allow comments on that particular video.
Ah, right, yes. He said something at the beginning about not allowing comments because he could end up losing his channel. That's fair enough, I think, you know, quite a few people are concerned about that they might lose their channel, especially if they've got a lot of subscribers. That's why we set up RadioAryan.com straight away. You know, right, okay, people are going to lose their channels. We'll set up our own website. We'll have our own platform. So we can't be deplatformed, which is, you know, what I would suggest anyone that has a sizable following on YouTube, set up their own website so at least they can cover themselves if YouTube deplatforms them. But just with this Russia and Israel thing, before we get into the war, Dennis, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, he says that it's not actually Putin cozying up to the Jews. He says it's the Jews cozying up to Putin, because Putin is so powerful in Russia. The Jews that do have money there want to get on the right side of him. So they get very friendly with him. And when Putin goes to Israel, he goes to the holy Orthodox Church places. And he obviously observes the Orthodox Church rituals. I'm not sure whether you would actually see him at the Wailing Wall, but he does get involved very much with the Orthodox Church there. And I think what we've got here, we've got a dichotomy between right-wing Jews and left-wing Jews. And in Israel, we've got the right-wing Jews. We've got a right-wing administration. In America, you've got a lot of left-wing Jews that are the Democrats, and the media is run by the left-wing Jews. And Putin is obviously right-wing. He's a traditionalist. So, you know, he falls down on the side of Netanyahu and the right-wing government in Israel, which is the same as the civic nationalists. You know, they're right-wing, so they say, right, well, Israel must be our friend because they're right-wing. Whereas where we're nationalists, we say, well, it's not the right or the left, it's the ethnicity that matters. So I think that's an essential difference. But I think that's what we're seeing playing out here, really, is Putin on the side of Israel, because it's got a right-wing administration, or at least that's got to play into it in some way.
As is Trump, yeah.
Yeah, and Donald Trump as well.
I think you're right. And that's why the press in the West have got Putin and Trump, of course, and the press in America, CNN, all them left-wing, and Hollywood, of course, all set against it. But no matter which way you look at it, whoever comes out on top, you know, the Jews don't lose.
Well, that's just it, isn't it? They're playing both sides. That's why they don't like nationalism, because they can't take a part in that, because they're not part of our ethnicity. So they're not allowed in, basically. So they hate it. They absolutely hate it. They want you to fall on the right or fall on the left, and then you're controlled by them. Well, what he's really trying to say with this video is that the war was lost due to the Enigma intercepts and the decrypts, which is what most people know about. We know about that now, that Britain was able to crack the code of the German secret code, and we knew what was going on at the end of the war. Again, this is one of the proofs that there wasn't any gassings going on at Auschwitz, because we could see the amount of coal that was going there and all the invoices. We knew what they were thanks to these decrypts. In fact, there's been a book that's actually been written about it. But the point that Brendan O'Connell is making is that it wasn't just that Britain cracked the codes. There was also information that was given to them in the first place to help them crack the codes. They had somebody that was in there that was quite high up that was feeding back, like the U-boat codes, for instance, and the Luftwaffe codes. And once, you know, the British codebreakers had a chance to look at these books, then they were able to work out what their machine was telling them, which I think is very believable. And he points to Wilhelm Canaris, General Canaris, the head of German intelligence. So what do you know about Canaris, Dennis?
Well, not a great deal, to be honest, but the excuse of why he did it was more the thing that I was looking at, because he said that he really was sick of what was going on the Eastern Front. And being a Christian, he felt it right only to help the Allies, which I find really a real strange comment, because if he's a Christian and he doesn't like what's going on the Eastern Front, then surely would he give information to help the Bolsheviks, which caused him more mayhem than anybody? It's just a real weak excuse, I find.
Well, looking into this Wilhelm Canaris. It seems that the Jews want to make him out to be a bit of a hero. He was actually tried for treason. He was executed for treason because he took part in the plot to kill Adolf Hitler, and it was also discovered. Oh, yeah. Because he was the head of intelligence, he was the head of the Abwehr, and it was discovered that he had set up like a fifth column within the Abwehr that was anti-Hitler, that was anti-National Socialist. And according to the Jews, he saved certain Jews and rescued certain Jews. So they want to create this idea that he was one of the, what are these words? That I forgot this. Momentarily gone out of my head. When they have these righteous Gentiles.
That's usually, yeah.
One of the righteous ones or whatever. They want to make him out to be a good guy anyway. And I think what they would also like to do is they want to make Hitler and the National Socialists out to be anti-Christian. So they'll say, he was doing this because he was a Christian. Not he was doing this because he was a traitor and he was probably paid for this. I mean, he may have had alternative Christian views, but we know that in Germany at the time, both the Protestants and the Catholics all supported Adolf Hitler, and they saw what they were doing as Christian. The rest of the world might have said National Socialism isn't Christian, but the National Socialists themselves very much saw what they were doing as Christian, and they saw that it tied in completely with their beliefs. You know, they saw that Jesus Christ, he was a National Socialist. He chased the moneylenders out of the temple. He fought against the Jews. And also Martin Luther, they saw him as he was National Socialist, or he was nationalist. He was fighting for Germany.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to say that this Wilhelm Canaris, he was on the side of Christianity and that's why he was a traitor, I don't think that really holds up, because this American idea of Christianity wasn't there. It didn't exist back then. I think you might be having a bit of a problem there with your sound, Dennis. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here, yeah. I just banged the mute on to get some water.
Ah, right, okay. Okay. Do you want to add any more to that about this Canaris?
Well, I think, really, you've hit the nail on the head. But, I mean, Brendan himself is a Christian. And so what he's saying, like, he thinks it's a reasonable reason for sending out information, where I'm saying if he's a Christian and the other guy's a Christian, he should know what the Bolsheviks are doing. And he does go on to say how bad the Bolsheviks were. So, and he explains just what they did to Christians. So I just can't see this excuse. Like you said, holding water. Yeah, the guy was a traitor, probably on good money, and Stauffenberg. I mean, one thing about Stauffenberg, you can't deny, is that he left the bomb under a table where all his mates were around. And some were killed and some were maimed. And he actually did that to people who'd probably been around his house, had meals, etc., drinks. You know, you've got to bear that in mind. You know, that was some kind of treasonous act.
So he didn't care about who else he took out, just so long as he took Hitler out. He was quite prepared to throw his friends under the bus. I mean, that's
right.
That's the sort of attitude you find with traitors. Well, the next point he brings up, I mean, you're saying that Brendan is Christian. Well, we're Christian as well. So I guess it's what sort of view you have of Christianity that is important here. But then he goes into Hitler, and he says that Hitler was bipolar and addicted to methamphetamine. And he talks about drugs being used in the war, and Hitler was prescribed drugs by his doctor. He was injected with vitamins and nutrients. He probably was also injected with methamphetamine, but he wouldn't have been addicted to it. The doctor would not have allowed him to get addicted to it. He would have been dependent upon it. He might well have been dependent upon it and needed to take it every day so that he could be awake and alert for 22 hours a day. But he wouldn't have been addicted to it. You know, the doctor would not have allowed him to keep injecting himself every couple of hours so he could get high. It would have just been so that he could function. And there's a difference between addiction and dependence. And I think a lot of the people that in the wars, they were using these drugs, especially painkillers. I mean, you've got people that have been maimed. They're going to become dependent on morphine.
Yeah,
and people that are fighting, they're going to become dependent on methamphetamine. I think actually ecstasy was developed during the war by the Germans as an appetite suppressant. Yeah. I mean, that's where a lot of these drugs actually came from, was from the military industrial complex. It's like LSD as well. And we know how that's connected with the CIA and how they use that as a truth serum. So that takes care of this allegation that he was addicted to methamphetamine. Bipolar. I don't really see any evidence for him being bipolar. Electric. I mean, he gave electric performances when he was speaking, but I don't think there was this, you know, this super high 1 minute and super low the next. What do you think?
Well, he had a way of, I mean, he started every speech really quiet and low key and built it up to a crescendo. Did it every time. It's just his way, really. But I think he's right about, you know, whoever fought in World War One must have come away with some kind of damage, whether it be physical or mental. I mean, I've seen the pictures of the shell shock soldiers. It's just incredible. And that's one of the reasons Hitler didn't want to go back to a world war again, because of the horrors, which, again, we'll talk about later on.
Massive damage was done to them, massive mental damage, post-traumatic stress, which they knew nothing about.
Exactly.
People would come back from the war and be hallucinating, all sorts of damage that was caused by it that wasn't actually identified. If there was a doctor at the time that said that Hitler was bipolar and it was one of Hitler's doctors, then that would be proof of that, I guess. But what I'm guessing is that that's somebody looking at him from today and saying, well, that looks like he's bipolar. I think that's somebody analysing him today, years later, and not actually knowing the man himself. Because I don't think there's any doctor's reports to say that. Well, the next bit he talks about is something which I wasn't really aware of. He talks about the Polish Catholics throwing the Bolsheviks back into Russia in 1920. And a really brave war that the Poles actually had against the Bolsheviks. And they did send them back in 1920. And as I was looking that up...
We covered it in, I think, second part of Masonic, I think.
Well, yeah, as I was looking that up, I came across the Intermarium.
And
We couldn't work out how it was spelled.
We
couldn't work out how it was spelled, so we couldn't find any reference to it. You know, you're looking up Intermarium and there's nothing there. And I actually found it today. And the Wikipedia description isn't of it being a group of Catholic countries fighting against Bolsheviks. They tried to put it across that it was like an alternative to the Lithuanian Grand Duchy. And it was like a sort of a Polish attempt at having an empire. So they're obviously trying to whitewash it. I think it's far more likely that it was Catholics trying to get the godless Bolsheviks back into their zone and protect Poland, because what the Russians wanted to do, what the Soviets wanted to do rather, they wanted to take Poland so that they had then had a connection to the communists that were in Germany, in Munich, and when the communists had their uprising in Germany, the Soviets wanted to be able to reach them, the Red Army to be able to reach them through Poland. So it was very important to them to take Poland. So the Poles prevented that from happening. Maybe it's something a little area of history that we should look into a little bit more in an episode, Dennis.
Yeah, I think the Bolsheviks eventually infiltrated, though.
What, infiltrated the Poles?
In Poland, yeah, I think so.
Well, that could be. I mean, they definitely didn't seem to want to be allying with Germany against the communists later on, did they?
No, that's true. You've read the book. But also the time when, you know, the negotiations on with Poland, with Germany because of the minorities, and the killings were very similar to the Bolsheviks, you know, eyes gouged out, you name it.
Yeah, lots of horrific stuff that went on later on. But then you can also think that the Germans paid or they gave the money to Lenin and Trotsky, didn't they, in that train to get over there into Russia near the end of the
First
World
War. That's the bankers, though, isn't it? You know, the Warburg.
They let them travel through and sent them on their way, knowing, you know, what that was being sent there. But then that's in the middle of a war, isn't it? Well, the
they planned that, didn't they? Warburgs and the rest of them,
Warburgs and the Rothschilds, and then he says that Hitler was funded by British Intel and the Rothschilds. You can say that, you know, there would have been some investment in the early stages, and they would have seen, or lots of people would have seen, that the National Socialists would have been a bulwark against communism. And if you're a capitalist, and if you own lots of factories, you don't want the communists to be taking over Germany, because you've got factories there, you've got investments there. So they would be likely to invest a bit of money in the nationalist parties. So I can understand that. But once Hitler had been voted in, then he wouldn't have been getting money from British intelligence or the Rothschilds, I don't think.
I don't think he ever did. I just think that there were industrialists, both German and some Russian dissidents, and like Henry Ford, he sent $50,000 on Hitler's birthday. He hated communism and the Jews, and he's an American industrialist. And I'm sure that there's others we haven't heard of. They just don't want communism, just like Trump and Putin, I believe.
When you look at Mussolini as well, because this is an allegation that's made about Mussolini, they say that, well, Mussolini, he was funded by MI6. and there's proof of that, but only right at the very beginning. Only right when he was very young. There's no proof of that.
Well, he used to be left-wing then, didn't he?
Yeah, there's no proof of it once, you know, he was in power. We've got to be careful of this. Maybe there may have been these connections at one time in their lives, but it doesn't mean that that stayed the same for all of their lives. And if you look at Gaddafi, he was funded by the CIA at first. If you look at Saddam Hussein, he was funded by the CIA at first.
Exactly.
They certainly weren't once they actually had power. So, you know, I think we can look at those examples and say, well, no, I don't think Hitler was funded by British intelligence. You really can't say that he was working for them. I mean, they were desperate to get rid of him, basically.
How many assassination attempts did he? I know it was something like 40 attempts.
But his idea, you know, it's logical. He says, look, Hitler was funded by the British intelligence, and he wasn't supposed to go in there and liberate Russia and protect Europe. What was supposed to happen is that Western Europe was supposed to coalesce together into the European Union, formed against the threat of Bolshevism, which is understandable.
I believe Stalin and the Bolsheviks first were run by the bankers, as I've mentioned before, with the Russian Revolution being won, unless, you know, the bankers had a bolt of lightning and suddenly a great charity and said to Lenin, you can have the country. Sure.
Well, what I'm thinking of here is, you know, Kalergi had his plan for the European Union right at the beginning of the 20th century, didn't he? Before the First World War.
True.
And so they wanted to form this European Union. And you can imagine them thinking, here's a great chance for us to help this on its way. We've got the Bolshevik hordes there in the East. What we'll do is we'll say to the countries in the West, you need to unite together into this union to protect yourselves against the Bolsheviks, and we'll help you draw up all the plans for it or what have you, just to encourage the EU to form. So, I mean, that may have been an idea in their minds, but obviously they weren't able to control Hitler. And, you know, he wasn't going to be controlled by the bankers. And he could see what was happening over there in the East. And he knew that he had to protect Western Europe from it. So that idea that it was so that the EU could form, that may have been an idea just at the very first, but there's no way that that could have continued for very long, I don't think. I mean, you know, his plans were definitely not dictated to him by bankers.
No. I mean, in another early part of Masonic, I go into the Roosevelt and Stalin relationship. And obviously, Uncle Joe and all this, and trying to give a good public opinion or an image to everybody. And I'm convinced more so even after one of the German politicians mentioned that everybody dealt with the Bolsheviks in Europe, which they will do because they're all Rothschild clones, if you like. They dealt with the Bolsheviks, even though they knew about the massacres in the Ukraine. That's every country in Europe.
All of them, apart from Germany.
Because, you know, the bankers were behind it, and the bankers owned, or these were the puppets of the bankers.
Well, Hitler knew that as well. I mean, if anyone knew what the connections that the bankers had to all of this, it was Hitler. I mean, he'd read Gottfried Feder's book. He got Breaking the Chains of Interest Slavery. He got rid of the bankers. He got rid of the Masons. When he got rid of the Masons, he went into their temples and he got all their documents, discovered all the conspiracy stuff. He knew that the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, that was the plan. That is what was going on. May not have been the absolute direct minutes from, you know, one of their meetings, but that is what the plan was. Put in practice. And that Bolshevik Revolution, that was the start of it. And he discovered that Stalin had plans for a June 1942 invasion of Western Europe, which is why he went into Moscow. Now, we know this. And Brendan O'Connell is basically...
As does Brendan, yeah.
Yeah, he's telling his listeners this. He's saying, look, you need to be aware that, you know, Western Europe was saved by Hitler. And he's not being pro-Hitler. He's just saying that that's a matter of fact. Hitler didn't just wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to invade Russia. Yeah. It was... It needed to be done. It had to be done. And I mean, and when they actually did that, when they liberated Lithuania and Latvia, these countries, before it actually happened, they'd had shipments of weapons that had been brought in. There'd been, you know, talks with the people over there. So they were aware that there was going to be an uprising, and the Soviets had scarpered by that time. By the time they actually moved in,
those what didn't like, and communists what didn't, they were getting it before the Germans arrived.
Yeah, well, they knew that they were being liberated. They weren't being invaded. They were being liberated. And then he talks about the fact that that was actually set back. Obviously, it was set back and they got caught in the snows. And I always thought that they were set back because of something to do with Greece or something to do with Italy. But he says it was to do with a Serbian uprising.
Yeah, set in Yugoslavia. What happened there was that the British had a big influence on the... out of favour, Serbian, the Serbian government, and the British had a big influence with them. And they managed to put them back in power again because Hitler had them removed. He hadn't put the Croatians in as yet, but he did put his own people in, and they were removed. And that meant... Italy first went in there, I think, to try and source it, but they couldn't source it. And Germany went in and sourced it in about 2 or 3 days.
And that put them back 6 weeks, which was just...
Apparently, yeah.
And that was the time that they needed, that extra 6 weeks, because of the weather. But he says it wasn't just the weather, it was also the fact that the communications were compromised, which the Germans weren't aware of, due to this Enigma machine and also due to this Canaris that was feeding this information back to them. Because they'd cracked the codes, they were able to read what was going on. And that was what really set them back, was because they'd had this traitor all along that had fed the information to the British. And then
I wouldn't be surprised if they were Freemasons as well, or ex-Freemasons.
No, that wouldn't surprise me either.
Because
there was that connection. So you got two things. You've got the weather, you've got this Enigma machine, and the third thing was all the weaponry that the Soviets had. And he's got a recording of Adolf Hitler talking about this, and he says that the German troops have destroyed 34,000 tanks. 34,000 tanks. And that is the largest... build up of tanks anywhere in the world up until that point. Where did they get all those tanks from? Where did they get the money from to do that? Just how did they build all these tanks? And I think what he's doing is he's saying, well, this came from America. This came from Roosevelt.
It has to be the bankers.
And what do you know about these tanks? Tanks Dennis, because I know you've got a bit in the documentary, haven't you? And you show them all on this railway line, and there's a voiceover to do with it.
Well, the thing was, I mean, it they couldn't believe it, because he said in this talk with Mannerism, I think it was somebody from one of the Nordic countries. Anyway,
from Finland.
Said that they just couldn't believe it. And they found these factories where people actually lived in poverty, and all they did was eat whatever they were given and make chanks. In just mass factories of people who were just, you know, homeless.
And this wasn't a defensive force, was it? This was building up a huge attack force, ready to go into Western Europe. Every penny that they had that was being spent on building these tanks and building these weapons, ready to invade in June, basically. And the Germans weren't prepared for all of these tanks. He's really shocked. Hitler is really shocked at what they actually came across, at how well prepared the Soviets were. Again, which is proof that Stalin was preparing to invade Western Europe.
And I think the famine in the Ukraine has a lot to do with it, because obviously they needed to sell the food to raise the money, because, you know, the bankers would have been pushing for, no doubt, for the usury. And so the Ukrainians had to suffer while the Soviets took all the money, and most of it probably went towards tank building.
So they starved the Ukrainians and used the money from all their grain to build up this force. Force of aggression, all these tanks. Well, then we've got a few bits then which are questionable. The sort of mainstream media bits that are reported. It talks about 17,000 disabled people that were euthanized. Now, I don't know if there were 17,000 that were euthanized, but we have talked about the euthanasia program before and how it was the carers of these people that said that they don't actually have a life anymore, and could you end their lives to end their suffering? And it was the carers, and they needed a doctor, and they needed two doctors, I think, and their carers. It wasn't, you know, the Germans going out bashing down the doors of disabled people's homes and killing all the disabled in there. It was people that had no quality of life. And also it got to a stage where there wasn't enough medication for them. There was a limited amount of medication. And first off, obviously the military need the medicine. Then, you know, you got your civilians, and then the disabled are right at the back of it. So they were the first ones that, they couldn't actually afford to give them the medicine. I know that it got that bad near the end.
They invented a substitute for morphine at the end, because they had no morphine. They actually invented a drug which did the job.
And I know the eugenic side of it, that was going on in America, that was going on everywhere else as well. They weren't really doing anything that's any different from anywhere else as far as the eugenics is concerned. And this euthanasia was ending the suffering of people that were in a really bad way of genetic deformities. And then he says that the actual Germans themselves, they were all being taught that they were Übermensch, and they'd had 7 or 8 years of going through school and being taught that they were better than everybody else. And I don't think that's quite accurate. I think that when they were being told they're better than everybody else, I think they were sort of being told that they had big boots to fill, and they had to be more honourable than anybody else, and they had to be more Aryan than anybody else. And that was the whole point of the SS. They were a new order of knights. You know, they were supposed to be, you know, the most intelligent, the brightest, the most polite, the most noble,
the fittest.
They weren't, we can just execute everybody else because they're lesser beings. It wasn't, you know, looking at it like that. And I think people should be proud of their race. You should think that your race is best and your nation is the best. It's like when you support a football team, you think your football team is the best. And it doesn't matter how badly they do, you still think they're the best. And it's the same with your nation. Every other people are like that about their nation. They all think their nation is the best in the world. It's only us that think that it's bad to think highly of yourselves. And when you do think highly of yourselves, then, you know, there's an encouragement there to improve yourself and to be the best that you can possibly be. If you know that you're capable of doing great things, or your nation is capable of doing great things, you're going to be encouraged to do great things. And that was the drift, I think, of the education that the Germans had. It wasn't saying nobody else is worth anything. It was saying you have the potential to be the best.
I don't know whether you remember Hitler's speech in Austria when you know, they finally brought him back into the Reich, and he said, I'm your teacher. And that's exactly what he did. When he found out, you know, this danger to Germany, he taught the population what the problem was, and everybody understood it and everybody knew it, which is why they never actually surrendered, even though they were getting flattened with bombs. And by the way, I saw some footage the other day. Now, I've never seen this footage before. It was only part of an opening scene for some kind of documentary. But the thing was, it showed the planes. Instead of showing the planes going over Germany at 20,000 feet or whatever, you know, and you just see the flames below, this was actual footage in daytime where you could see them attacking the working class houses. And trust me, it were a pretty sight. I mean, they must have known there were babies and children and women and whoever down there. It was just, it was gut-wrenching.
Well, the Germans had very strict orders on how they were to treat prisoners, how they were to treat civilians. They would be shot if they did any looting. And at the end of the war,
rapid.
Yeah, the Americans and the British, I mean, they stole even these watches from the Germans, their hereditary watches that had been handed to them by their father and their father before that. And yet the Germans themselves, they found these little booklets on them with all the orders of how they were to treat people. And, you know, they would have been shot for doing something like that. And in the camps as well. Go on.
The exception to the rule, I think, is the Soviet Union. Not that they weren't disciplined themselves, but I think with the Soviet Union not interested in any, you know, Geneva Conventions, and they did the barbaric kind of animalistic cutting off of genitals and et cetera, even while soldiers were alive, then I think there must have been a point where Hitler said, you can't fight these people with choir boys. And so I think there were a couple of units at least, Oscar, I can't remember his second name there, was one of them, where, you know, a lot of them had been in prison and they went out there and they did fight fire with fire. But how can you not fight fire with fire?
Well, this is what Brennan said. He said the fighting on the Eastern Front was absolutely horrific, and it was a picnic in the West. And, you know, the Soviets hadn't signed up to any of these treaties, but the Germans had. So I guess you could say, well, you know, we're only fighting by the same rules that you set for yourselves to the Soviets. And when they were burning the, I guess maybe when he's saying this, they were taught to be Übermensch, maybe that's because the Germans were burning these huts that the peasants, the Russian peasants were living in. But they saw these huts as, you know, they were just made out of wood and straw. They weren't made out of bricks. They didn't have many possessions.
Yeah, but he mentions the massacres, doesn't he? And I'm saying that Stalin brought a law out in 42, torchman laws, which allowed him to dress up as Waffen-SS, massacre a village, for being loyal to the Germans when the Germans were coming in. And then when the Germans were retreating, these people suffered, but they left two or three alive to tell the story that it was actually the Waffen-SS. And these papers actually lie in Washington today, the order number and everything. But it's commonly known as the Torchman Laws, and that then debunks every single photograph that we've ever seen of German officers, so-called, over a pit and shooting all these people, because that's exactly what the Russians did in German uniforms.
Yeah, that's a good point, that. Good point. And I forget whether we did a podcast on that or who it was that exposed that, but there is a lot of information on that somewhere. Well, the next bit, he appears to believe in the story of the gas chambers and of people being gassed. And I was a bit disappointed in that. I would have thought that, you know, because he's in a, what would you say, an investigative journalist, an investigative reporter, you would think that he would have investigated that and you know, discovered that there was actually, there's no autopsy report of anyone gassed in the whole of World War II. And you would think that he would understand that. But his reasoning was really that this final solution thing is because people say today, oh, well, yes, you know, well, Hitler should have finished the job off. He should have just killed them all off. But that's just, you know, people saying things. When it actually comes down to actually doing something like that, I'm not so sure that people would do. We know the other races. We know the Chinese would. We know... you know, we know that the Jews would, but would an Aryan man do that? Just wipe out a whole race? I don't think we would.
Well, I think if anybody wants to know the details of the engineering of the Holocaust, all they need do really is read the minutes of the first Ernst Zundel trial in Canada, where all the Jews turned up and were questioned by Doug Christie, and Doug Christie ripped them apart. They'd never seen or found one body that had been gassed. This is mentioned in his court trials. And so much so that when the trial ended, it was a mistrial for some reason. The judge probably said, I've had enough, because it was televised as well, I believe. But when the second trial came around, these Jews, and these were top Jews who'd been in the first trial giving evidence, they had to go back and change all the books and all the lies in those books, because they could now face damages. So when the second trial was called, none turned up because they'd had enough after the first one. So it's the minutes of the first trial that people need to, because that's all done by law and it's there in front of you.
The witnesses were discredited, weren't they? The witnesses were discredited at the Ernst Zundel trial. And you've also got the logistics of the method of execution, throwing cyanide pellets in through a hole in the roof. Not coming out of taps, coming out of showers, but throwing pellets through a hole in the roof. Throwing pellets through a hole in the roof wouldn't do anything.
Well, you just remind me, actually, Rens to the night, when he's, like I said earlier, only mentioned the documentary, he actually said that he knew a German, I think it was his mother who told him, and he was telling Rens that the Germans, there'd be a hospital there, where these people from the East were coming in, frightened of communism, the Germany opened the doors. But someone had to go to an hospital, and all the German soldiers did, they got the Cyclone B cans and threw them on the floor in the hospital and left them. That wasn't to kill those in hospital, it was to kill the lice, because you could hit the lice on the head with an hammer and they'd die. But the thing that seemed to control them,
hit them on the head with a can of Cyclone B. I think they used to have to heat it up, didn't they? It had to be heated up to form a gas. I mean, just pellets on their own really isn't going to do anything, unless they eat them, of course, which is, you know, those cyanide capsules. But a capsule itself, cyanide itself, it isn't in a gaseous form. It's in like a pellet form. So it's just not possible to actually do these things. And I am surprised that he hadn't worked that out. I think he was just going on the fact that it's believable that people could do that. People could, you know, with a mass hysteria, they could do something like that. And I'm not so certain about that. And then he was talking about, white nationalists. He's quite anti-white nationalists. But he seems to be under the impression that we're all here to help drive the Jews to Israel. He's got a big thing about this greater Israel. The Jews want to set up this big settlement there that covers all the land that they had, or that the Israelites had in the Old Testament. And he thinks that's what all this is about, and that the white nationalists are sort of, some of us are in the pay of the Jews, and it's all to encourage them to move to Israel. And, you know, I think he's missing a few bits there. And obviously white nationalists, and that's not our motivation. Our motivation is saving our race. And it's perfectly natural to want to do that. And he was pointing out that Pat Little, he thinks that Pat Little must be funded by the Jews to drive them to Israel, because he says things like they rape babies. And that's a shocking thing to say that the Jews rape babies. But think about it. They do. That it's called a bris. When those mohels do that circumcision, straight after they cut the bit of flesh off, they perform fellatio on the baby. That is raping a baby. That's what he's talking about there. So it's shocking language to use, but that is what's going on. It's like when you say Muhammad is a pedophile. That is what Muhammad was doing. He had a 6-year-old girl that was his wife, and he consummated the marriage when she was 9 years old. Okay, they have had different cultural sensibilities back then, but that is still pedophilia. Okay, the Jews have different cultural sensibilities to us, but their circumcision ritual is the raping of a baby. So it's shocking language to use, but you know, I think Pat Little's great. I think he's really good. I really approve. What do you think of Pat Dennis? Have you seen his work?
Well, I was on an interview with him once. I didn't really know that much about Hitler. It was more into the modern day situation. But I always got, I could never get a comfortable feeling. I don't know. Might just be me. I don't know. There was something missing when I couldn't put my finger on it.
I think he does really well. I think he puts across a good image. He seems an honourable man, definitely an honourable man. At the moment he's doing It's Okay to Be White demonstrations, and they put tape over their mouths and they don't fight back, and they film it. And he just seems to be dedicated to exposing the Jews. And
well, I saw him outside a bar one day. He got beat up, didn't he?
I think his cameraman got attacked. But I mean, there are so many different ways to expose what's going on, you know, to our people and what's happening to our people. And he's at one end of it, doing the most hardcore extremist exposing where he can in America. And then at the other end of it, you've got the civic nationalists that are just exposing what the Muslims are doing, you know, right up to a group like UKIP. But I think all the way along that spectrum, it's people that are really trying to do what they can for their people in whatever way they can. And he's just, right at the George Lincoln Rockwell end of it.
I think he's right about some nationalist leaders, though. Even I don't trust some of them.
Well, I think
it's all right.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are, by necessity, I think they're working with the Jews. I think every political party now has got to have a Friends of Israel division, haven't they? If they haven't got a Friends of Israel part, they're not going to get any.
Probably.
I can't think of any nationalist, well, there certainly hasn't been one in Britain that, hasn't made a point of showing how friendly they are to Israel. And there aren't any on the continent either that I can think of. I mean, AFD.
Not at all, no.
AFD, they've got an advert on at the moment saying about how wonderful white people are, and it's going to have a wonderful white person every day that they're going to celebrate. And the first one was Albert Einstein, Jewish.
Well, I bet he loved being white.
I couldn't believe that. You know, I'm thinking, oh, yes, this is wonderful. And then he says, oh, and Albert Einstein is the first one. But, you know, these well, other parties the old, as well.
I was just saying, one of the alt-right leaders, I can't remember his name now, was going to do an interview. We were both going to sit in it. But he sent word saying he didn't want to talk about Adolf Hitler. So I said, oh, well, that's me gone.
not much else for you to get into when you've done a documentary.
Exactly, yeah.
All about him.
I'm going to talk about jokes.
Well, you know, we've also got people in the alt-right media that do work with Jews. I mean, I would say not, you know, white nationalists shouldn't, but the civic nationalists, some of them do. Some of them in the alternative media do. And he was trying to put across this idea of, you know, getting together a coalition, and it doesn't matter what race you are, it doesn't matter what religion you are. And that's missing the point that it's the white race that is being wiped out here. All the other races are increasing, and it's the white race that is decreasing. You know, what do we make? 8% of the world, and the rest of the world is non-white. That's the real thing.
Christianity can be attacked. Well, you can't say nothing to about Muslims or Jews, but anybody can kick Christianity.
And he seems to think that this, you know, it's all about Israel and the Zionist Jews. And there's so much more to it than that. The cultural Marxism that's going on, the promotion of homosexuality, all of this sort of thing. And, you know, one of his bits of evidence, you know, it actually points to that. And he talks about his videos and which videos gets banned. And he says, well, Google want me on. Google want my videos on. And he says, when he talks about Donald Trump or Alex Jones, they get banned. But if he's talking about Israel, but if he's talking about Israel, then it's absolutely fine. So he's saying that what that means is that Google doesn't want people to know the truth about Trump or Alex Jones. And I don't think that's it at all. I think it's that Google are left-wing Jews. So they don't like the right wing. So, you know, they think it's fine for him to talk about Israel because they want Israel to be criticized. They're on the side of the Palestinians because they're left-wing Jews. And this shows...
Well, I won't go that far, but...
That's a strange...
Can't be talking on the side of the Palestinians.
No, but, you know, they don't mind him criticizing Israel. And they'd be quite happy to have criticism of Trump or Alex Jones. The reason why they're removing his videos that talk about Trump or Alex Jones is because they want to ban Alex Jones and Donald Trump from the internet. And they probably think that his videos are positive about Alex Jones and Donald Trump because it will just be one of those little bots that they have that is actually telling YouTube that they need to remove that video. It won't actually be somebody sitting there watching it. It will be an algorithm.
I think it was CNN, weren't it?
Yeah.
CNN removed Alex Jones.
Well, I think it's more likely to be an algorithm that's picked up on the fact that he's talking about Donald Trump a lot and he looks like he's a conspiracy theorist. So they probably assumed that he supports Donald Trump and have assumed that he likes Alex Jones. And that's why they've removed him. That would be my guess.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly one reason, yeah.
And then right at the end, he comes up with this something that I've never heard before. And this is 9-1-1 was a Soviet-era operation between Russia and Israel, and it should have taken place in 1996. But the correct me if I've got this wrong, Dennis. But the security company the security company that was responsible for the World Trade Center is very important in this, and because it was an Israeli terrorist who had killed lots of people, they lost the contract in 1996. So it was put back until 2000 and whatever it is when it actually happened. And then he was saying that it's a Soviet era operation. And that just got me thinking, well, I wonder if there was any sort of deep state operations like that that were set up, that were sort of planned to occur in 10 years' time. What happens when the state falls apart? You know, do these people that are deep undercover that are working on these projects, do they continue with the project? And also just this idea that it was an operation between Russia and Israel. I hadn't heard that before. What did you think of that?
Well, I think that possibly comes from the fact that after the wall came down, a lot of Russians come to Britain and a lot of Russians come to America and a lot of Russians went to Israel. And there's this link between all three. I mean, if you remember in the Great Story, I mentioned that when this all happened, Britain brought out a law saying that only Germany committed war crimes, which was protection of these Bolsheviks coming into the country who couldn't then be taken to court. So there's a link.
That was in the 90s, was it, that they said that only Germany could be? Ah, right.
Yeah.
Because I remember not being able to find that when looking at the Nuremberg trial. So that was deliberately done so that these Jews couldn't get held up for war crimes. Interesting stuff. He's definitely interesting research that he does. Do you watch a lot of his stuff, do you, Dennis?
I have seen a number of his videos. Yeah, I find it quite interesting. He gets quite passionate at times.
Well, I'm sure he'll be pleased to know that you're a fan, and have to see what he thinks of our discussion over his video tonight. All right, thanks very much for coming on, Dennis. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truth Pull Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.